Hello, everyone. Welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. This week's episode is brought to you by Crunchyroll, the place for all the anime that you love. And you can try it free for 30 days by visiting crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. That's crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. Now, all right, I want to give a big shout out to all of my new patrons, Patreonins. As many of you know, if you've been listening to the podcast, I recently joined Patreon, and you can find my Patreon page at patreon.com/talknerdy. You can also go to my website, carasantamaria.com, and click on the Patreon buttons there. And you help support the podcast, keep it 100% free to download, and help me work towards that goal of removing ads altogether from the podcast. We'll see if we can get there together. Now, I have some amazing patrons this week, so I want to give a big shout out to Ron Noblock. Thank you so much for your incredibly generous donation. I also want to thank Rob Barcy, Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and Chuck Pell. Thank you guys from the bottom of my heart for supporting the podcast and, I don't know, helping me keep churning it out and making me feel just all around special. Also, oh yeah, little announcement, not a very big announcement, but a small one. I started a little reading list on my website, and I'm going to find the URL for you right now. If you go to carasantamaria.com/reading-list. Yeah, that's it. carasantamaria.com/reading-list. You will see all of this great recommended science reading, and it's ever growing. These are all books I've read personally. They're all books that I would personally recommend, and they link out to Amazon, and I've started a little Amazon affiliate program there to help support the podcast as well. So if you see a book there that you like and you click through and you decide to buy it, a percentage of those proceeds will go to the podcast. So for all of you who message me and ask me about what science books I would recommend, you can check them out there. You can see them kind of in order. The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat by Oliver Sacks, Stiff by Mary Roach, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks by Rebecca Skloot. The list goes on and on. So thank you for reminding me that that's something that I should do and inspiring me to do it. I've been having a lot of fun with it, and hopefully you will now too. All right, guys, without any further ado, I am super thrilled to have my next guest on the podcast, mostly because I podcast with him, or I should say I radio it up with him on a regular basis. He is the host of Dogma Debate Radio. I have actually a regular segment on Dogma Debate Radio called Get Your Science On. But he doesn't just do that. He is also the CEO of Secular Media Group, LLC, and the founder of AtheistAudiobooks.com. Please welcome David Smalley. There we go. Yeah. Recording. Hey, David. You are all the way in Los Angeles.
I'm all the way in Los Angeles. Exhausted.
You just got here?
No. Well, kind of. I passed through. We actually drove from Dallas.
Gotcha. Because you were in Riverside earlier.
I was in Riverside tonight, but I'm saying like 5, 7, 11, 12, 13 days ago. Uh-huh. I'm losing track of time and city and state place. I guess that's how we would say it. And so we came up Southern California, went up to NorCal and did several shows and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then we toured all the way back down. And
gotcha.
So tonight I was in Riverside with Riverside Atheists, and we did a talk out there. And
so you did a talk. Did you also record any podcasty goodness, any radio goodness?
I did two live broadcasts in the last 72 hours.
So, yeah. So your voice is just going to crap out right in the middle of
it. Who knows? I don't know. Sometimes I do voiceovers for audiobooks, and I go for 8 or 9 hours, and I never have an issue.
Seriously?
Yeah.
I have concerns sometimes where just from doing on-camera work where I'm like out in the field reporting and I'm not talking the entire day, but I am interviewing during the interviews, and I'll get home at night and my voice will be gone. Wow. Or Or I'll go out with friends to dinner. I mean, I don't drink and I'm not like a big party person, so I don't go out to clubs or anything. But sometimes just going to a dinner here in LA, the restaurants can be so loud that you're just talking. You're trying to just have a normal conversation for an hour. And by the time you get home, you're like, oh my God, I lost my voice. I must have been yelling.
I think that's the biggest deal. One of the talks, they had me at Pacific Catch.
Okay, don't
and
know, but
it's
sure.
up in Mountain View.
Oh, pretty. And I love Mountain View.
It's gorgeous, and the restaurant was awesome, but it is a very, very loud place.
Yeah,
and they
that's
had me
tough.
Doing a talk at a restaurant that's very loud. And so the walls weren't really walls. They were like see-through wooden things. And so
everything's just leaking out.
We were literally between the bar and the kitchen.
Ugh.
And so it was like the loudest place possible. So it was fun. It was good. But I had to project a lot and there was no microphone. And
by
the end of that, I was pretty, I was feeling it. But I don't know. I think most of the stuff I do is pretty low key, pretty soft.
You definitely you've got like a smooth kind of, you got such a radio voice. Yeah. So speaking of your radio voice, for anybody who's listening to Talk Nerdy, which is probably a very small percentage, who doesn't know about your show and about, I mean, they should because I plug it all the time because I'm on it all the time.
And that's awesome.
Yeah. But for maybe somebody who needs further explanation, or maybe this is the first time they've ever tuned in, why don't you give us a little rundown of what it is you do on Dogma Debate?
So Dogma Debate is the primary, or I guess you would say the flagship radio program of the parent company, which is Secular Media Group LLC. And there's a whole mission going on with Secular Media Group LLC. We've got atheistaudiobooks.com, which also secularaudiobooks.com goes there too, because we're branching out into like fiction and children's books and really cool stuff like that. But Dogma Debate itself is kind of where it all started, and it's really it's kind of unique in that it's designed as a platform for really believers to come on and present their ideas, as long as they're okay with being challenged on those ideas in a very respectful way. And not a lot of people have, I guess you would say, the desire to even deal with that or the patience to sit through it all. And so I really pride myself in trying to do that, because I really think, you know, you take someone who is just unable to even contemplate that they could be wrong about something. And I like planting seeds of doubt and just showing them that we're not all, you know, out here trying to destroy them. It's more about reaching out and seeing. And that's part of what my talks are. The talks I've been touring is called Being the Non-Sheep of the Family. And so you're the only one, or you're one of the few non-believers in your family. How do you deal with that? Do you reject them? Why do we continue to seek approval and acceptance from people that we don't even really respect their views?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's about respecting yourself, seeking their understanding, not their approval, being very upfront about your disagreement, but instead of abandoning them completely, understand that you don't have to abandon the flock. But you don't have to be approved by the flock either. What you can do is stick around, continue to love them, but try to create more wolves out of those sheep and say, look, I'm here for you. They all have, you know, doubts, every one of them, every single Christian or any believer at all who's been on my show, they have doubts about their beliefs. It's just about finding out what those are, talking about those, and letting them know that we're a safe place to share those doubts, and that all of those wonderful, warm, fuzzy feelings they get about their religion, we have that too, and we just call it humanism. And they can have it without all the guilt and all those bad things that come with their religion. All the bigotry and misogyny and, you know, guilt, self-hatred, all these types of things. You can have it without that. And so I like to show, I like to sort of extend an olive branch to those that are believers, and that's what Dogma Debate was known for. And so it's a very long show. It's usually 2.5 to 3.5 hours, and we've been guilty more than 100 episodes of going over 4 hours. But we try to break it up into segments and kind of keep things moving kind of quickly. And that's really what it's been about. It's also a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher and all those other wonderful things too. But it's a live radio show. It goes out live, and however it goes out, that's how we keep it. We don't do any editing or taking anything down after the fact. So
I love that. That's the best part. I mean, I hardly ever edit this, only because I'm lazy and editing is a lot of work and I don't have anybody to help me.
It's extremely
It's
hard.
A lot of work. And so the only time I'll edit is usually when lately I've been doing more remote hits, because I can't always get people to come and sit down in my dining room. Sometimes people live in other parts of the country and they'll record their track, and then I have to weave them together. And sometimes Skype craps out on you. Sometimes you drop the, you know, the conversation, you have to keep picking it back up. And so those are the times when I'll usually edit, but it's very rare that I'll edit out when somebody's like, you know, says something off the cuff or when my dog starts barking or I'm just like, I don't care. Deal with it, guys. Deal with it.
Oh yeah. My dog barks every now and then. I didn't have a dog for a very, very long time and we just now got one. And that's been something I really have to get used to. I cannot control the dog barking and you just can't flat out. And the fortunate thing about it is we have a staff. We have about 48 people that work through Dogma Debate or Secular Media Group in some way.
Wow.
Mostly volunteers. Mm-hmm. Some are paid contractors, very few employees. Mm-hmm. And very, very, very largely based and built on volunteers.
Yeah.
And so luckily we do have a production team that if someone drops off a Skype, I don't have to stop what I'm doing. I can just kind of vamp and continue talking, but the producer works in the control room to get that person back on the line.
Yeah,
I don't have to
nice.
Scramble and go, oh, well, what were we talking about? Let's start over type thing.
Especially you know? As a show where you have like multiple interviews and multiple segments, whereas the way that I do my podcast is basically you and me. So if you just disappeared from the table, if you were just right. like, I'll be back. And I was Poof. Like, David, what? No, but I don't know what to say without you here. Like I'm all alone. Yeah. So I gotta say, it's funny because when you tell me what kind of the original concept of Dogma Debate was and how it's evolved over the years and how a lot of it really is about that olive branch to believers more than anything, it makes me wonder how many believers are really interested in listening to a program where their beliefs are going to be challenged. Do you think that's a big percentage of the kind of population of believers, or do you think it's a very specific kind of progressive and interested and, I don't know, just curious group of people that like to consume Dogma Debate?
There's definitely a progressive side, specifically Christians, mm-hmm. who are interested in hearing these views. But the funny thing about it is the more hardcore fundamentalists still listen to my show because they want to call in and say, the last Christian you had on isn't a real Christian. I'll have you on your knees in 10 minutes. Get me on your show. I'll show you what real Christianity is. And then they come on and there's this kind of the same progression.
Yeah.
And then a few episodes later, I'll get 15 more emails of Christians going, oh no, that guy wasn't a real Christian. You need to have me on your show and I'm going to show you all about Christianity. And so that's, you know, I kind of still get both. I get the progressives, but I still get the more hardcore fundamentalists because the hardcore fundamentalists want to argue against the more progressive Christians.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's, I mean, because I think in many ways it's a threat to the, when you think of a fundamentalist, you know, fundamental to that mm-hmm. is conservatism. And when you have right. a progressive who wants to, you know, fold science into the religion or who wants to make sure that, you know, oh, yeah, women can be priests or, yeah, gays can get married. And, like, we can figure out how to kind of reconcile these things. Fundamentalists are not okay with that. And it's interesting to see how not monolithic religion can really be. Right. And I think that sometimes we as atheists have a hard time. We are at fault of kind of lumping all religious people into the same group. And obviously that's a huge fallacy, as you can tell, because you interact with these people probably more than any of the atheists that I know. I mean, what you do on Dogma Debate is like my worst nightmare. Like the idea of debating or even just having regular conversations with believers and hearing, to me, what I sometimes roll my eyes at, like what I think sure. of as like tired arguments. And also I don't think personally I have those chops. I'm not a debater. I don't think. Somebody could run circles around me and I'd be like, no, but you're wrong. Like, I know you're wrong. Just give me a week to write an article about why you're wrong. Because awesome. I'm not sure if I can just pull all this stuff out of my ass right now. But, you know, I know for some people, like for you, it's fun for you, isn't it?
It is. It's fun. And I think it's important because you're right. A lot of times it's the same regurgitated sort of apologetics that kind of goes on.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is, I think it's important for people to hear because I'm not necessarily debating that person or having a discussion with that person to change their mind. Like, we've had a few people who came on our show as apologists who are now active in the atheist community.
That's great.
So we have been effective at some sort of conversion rate. It's a very small percentage, but it has happened. The real help, I think, is that all atheists have some form of believer in their family or close friends. And so even though last week I may have had on a pastor who was very liberal and progressive and pro-gay marriage and all these other things, this week I may have on a pastor who is completely anti all of those things. Well, Leonard, listening in Wisconsin, probably has people in his family that fit both of those profiles. Mm-hmm. And so he can sort of hear how we talk to the more hardcore guy versus how we talk to the more progressive guy, or how we talk to the Mormon or whatever. And he can be like, oh, wow, you know, this is kind of an approach I can take with this person, and this is an approach I can take with this person. I don't know, when you came on and did a segment recently, specifically, actually, it was two segments where you addressed some of these ridiculous arguments from science facts that proved evolution was wrong or some nonsense.
And they misspelled science in the URL.
Yeah, which is how we knew it was a credible source. You were like, at first, you were totally like,
I was like,
serious?
David, I'm not doing this.
I'm not doing this. This is ridiculous.
And then you had to kind of explain to me, like, no, I really think that my specific audience this would be very good for. Like, when I think about, if I were to sit down on Talk Nerdy and be like, I'm going to refute the, everybody would be like, yeah, obviously.
Yeah, dumb, changing it. Yeah. I'm going to go listen to something else.
Well, just because my listeners, for the most part, it's not that I'm preaching to the converted necessarily, but I think that my listeners, for the most part, are very progressive listeners. I probably do have some believers that are listeners because they're very interested in the science component of my show, but I don't think that I probably have any fundamentalist listener. I would be very surprised if I had anybody who was like a young earth creationist listening to my show, unless they were doing it just to be like trolling.
Well, let me say this. You may be surprised. And the reason I say that is I was at the American Atheist Convention last year. Mm-hmm. We did two live broadcasts, and I'll be doing that again, by the way, this year, and actually next week.
Yeah, very soon.
I'll be doing two live broadcasts there, or this week, or whenever they hear it. Who cares?
Probably, yeah, this week, you're
just
right.
Just like in like 10 minutes, whenever you're hearing this. I'm probably doing it right now.
He's doing it 3 weeks ago, guys. Yeah.
Right. I'm doing it last year.
Yeah.
And so last year I actually did it. And for my second show, I went down and got one of the protesters who was down there with like this giant 6-foot cross. And they were warning us on stage, do not engage the protesters. Security has been called twice.
Yeah.
And all of these things. And I went up to Dave, who's a friend of mine, and it's Dave Silverman. And I was like, Dave, would you object if I brought the protester in? And he went, you and only you, but no, I won't object if you do it. And I was like, thanks, buddy. And then I went to the hotel security and they were like, hell no, we're not taking a protester into an atheist convention. And so then I spent the next 2 hours talking with the protester and security, convincing them that it was okay.
Yeah.
So eventually he comes in, they let him come in, and he joins me live for a live radio show in front of about 90 atheists, because Dave gave me this little stuffy back room at the convention because he thought I wanted to do quiet recordings like this.
Yeah.
And I do like Jimmy Fallon for atheism style. Let's get crazy, you know? And so, I mean, I think in San Jose, we had over 200 people show up that were like losing their minds. And then like the 2 days before that, we had 140 or something that kind of gathered in this room. And I love putting on a live sort of performance, not just a
lot more fun. Like, I would definitely do this that way if that also didn't sound like a huge pain in my ass.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. It is scary. But it really is. Like, I've definitely done live podcasting before, and it's so much more fun because the energy just fuels you.
Exactly. So I bring the guy in, we're talking, and as we're talking on air, I said something about, does it make you nervous being in a room full of all these atheists? He looks around and he says, actually, no, I was kind of hoping I would see Jacqueline Glenn in here. I'm a huge fan. And so you probably have a fan base like that as well. And I'm telling you, they listen, but they just don't tell their pastors that they listen.
And
see, you know?
And that's the thing. I guess when I say I probably don't have any young earth creationists, it makes me wonder, like, is that guy really a young earth creationist? Is he not sure if he's a young earth creationist? Is he a questioning young earth creationist? Yep. And all of those things. I mean, yeah, is it really that important that somebody have a label? You know, I think it's pretty interesting how, just like I said, most religious folks are not monolithic. We sometimes forget that atheism is not monolithic.
Absolutely.
And especially to the outside world, maybe people listening who aren't non-believers or who aren't comfortable calling themselves atheists, even though they are non-believers, they're are so many different types. I mean, you guys, the Talk Nerdy listeners, you listened to my episode with David Silverman. We were just talking about that. And he is very different than you are, David. Absolutely. Like, very different. He's kind of a non-apologetic, poke the beast, intentionally get a rise out of people, atheist, and that because he's an activist and that's the direction of his activism. Mm-hmm. And I always say, I think it takes all types, because if there weren't the Silvermans out there and then there weren't the, I guess, more understanding and sympathetic and empathetic Smalleys out there and everybody in between, you wouldn't see this kind of movement, this activist movement of acceptance and understanding. Everything would just kind of stay the same. Mm-hmm. If it was only the Silvermans out there, exactly. Probably people would really not like us.
Yep.
But maybe our cause wouldn't be furthered in a kind of a legislative sense, right. You know? And so it really takes all of that. And for me, I think I had a moment of understanding a little bit earlier in my career that kind of that new atheist mentality, which I wholeheartedly used to be. And don't get me wrong, I love Richard Dawkins and I miss Christopher Hitchens and I love the books that they wrote and the talks that they've given. And I agree with so much of what they say, but I used to kind of be like that. And I realized that being like that was not very effective as somebody who is probably slightly more interested in furthering science literacy than I am. I mean, and granted, atheist activism is very important to me too, but science literacy to me comes first and foremost. And the worst way to get people to trust scientists, to try and understand the science more fully, is to be like, you're an idiot. I'm right. Listen to why I'm right. I can't believe you believe in God, you moron. Like, that's not going to help anybody. Nobody's going to be like, wow, I really want to listen to you talk to me that way.
Exactly.
It's shitty.
Yeah.
It's really shitty. And so it's really cool that you have people on your show that come from all walks of life, that have all sorts of different, I don't know, questions, and that you don't belittle them, you don't make fun of them, you don't ridicule them into, because that's a big, I think, divisive argument in the atheist community is, are there people who deserve to be ridiculed? Should we ridicule people into being embarrassed that they're holding on to these beliefs? Or should we always respect a belief even if we don't respect it? You know, should we pretend to respect a belief even if we really don't respect it?
It was Aristotle that said, it is the mark of an educated mind to entertain an idea without accepting it. Mm-hmm. So you can entertain an idea, you can talk with the person, you don't have to accept it, right? And so, and I think my friend Pete Boghossian refers to people who are hardcore fundamentalists, he refers them as pre-contemplatives, people who are not even interested in contemplating. And in his book, I love him to death, and I support 99.9% of his book. The one thing, and I've told him this, that I disagree with is he says pre-contemplatives aren't allowed at the adult table.
Yeah.
He's like, no.
Common mentality.
He's like, if you're not willing to at least say I could be wrong about this, I'm not even going to talk to you. Mm-hmm. And so I told Pete, send me all your pre-contemplatives. I love them. And then once they're willing to, you know, I take pride in that. I want to talk with them. And I think there's a series of phases. And I think many people who at one time were believers, and you were Mormon,
right, at one time.
So I think people, and I was very hardcore Baptist. Mm-hmm. And so I was part of a music ministry. I was a drummer for an all-black gospel choir, and I had so much fun.
That sounds awesome, yeah. Actually.
Oh, I still miss it. Like, there are times where I want to go do it.
That's the biggest thing I miss too, is the music.
Yeah, absolutely.
For sure.
And so I think there are phases that we tend to go through, mm-hmm. right? And some sort of take a Wiccan path for a while and come back. And I didn't go that route, but some do. And I think if you're a pre-contemplative, right? And then you move to the ability to be able to say, I could be wrong about my position. And then that's when you start looking into, how was the Bible canonized, and how much do we know about Paul? And then you start wondering how this whole thing goes. And then as you sort of transition into, wow, there's this whole world out there that's based in reality and science, I want to know more about it, then you start entertaining, okay, evolutionary biology, let me wrap my head around it. And then I think that's when what you do becomes so important. Mm. But you're right. I think if you take someone who's a total pre-contemplative, hardcore fundamentalist, young earth creationist, they are not a Christian because of scientific observation or experiment or some court case where facts were presented.
No.
They are there out of emotion.
Totally.
Right?
Out of emotion and out of, what's the word I'm looking for? Just comfort. you know, familial comfort. It's like they were raised in it. It's all they knew. It's all they've seen.
Community.
And it's just been reinforced and reinforced with strong emotional ties.
Right. And so if someone is in that state and they aren't even considering the fact that they could be wrong and they sit down and say, well, you know, my grandma died and I know I'm going to see her someday. And one day I was really broke and a check showed up in the mail from an anonymous person. And I know that was God taking care of me and everything is working right. And you go, here's a fossil, stupid. You know, there's a fossil. There's, we have proof. And even if you're not condescending, the fact that you're bringing facts to an emotional argument doesn't make any sense, right?
Yeah.
And so I like to meet them where they are. If they want to talk about science, I need help with that. That's not my specialty. That's where folks like you come in. But I think most of them are just into that emotional side.
I think you're so right. And so I gotta say, God bless you for that, because that is just not something I would ever want to do. But I think it's so important, but it requires literally the patience of a saint. And you're a dad, you know what I mean? And I think that you have a patience that's been crafted into you. Maybe that's how you've always been. And you also, what I love about your show is that you do it where you live, and where you live is where a lot of people who are believers live. Mm-hmm. I used to live there. You know, you live in Dallas. Do you live in the city of Dallas, or do you live in the burbs?
I'm in Garland.
You're in Garland. Okay. So I grew up in Plano, born and raised.
We're 15 minutes apart.
Exactly. Yeah. And I was there, I mean, until I was 24 years old, I think I was in Plano, Texas. I went to Denton. I went to Denton when I was 20 or maybe even 19. So I was in Texas, though, until I was 24 years old. Plano, Texas until 19, then moved to Denton, did my undergrad, my master's there. And then I got out. I was like, I got to get out of here. I went to New York, and then I came to LA. I personally feel like I'm at home here. And I think that there's something about being out and being around my friends. And I find myself making mistakes where I will just literally assume that no one believes in God, because I'm so used to being around people that are total secularists. Yeah. I have a very good friend who's a scientist who is Christian, and I forget it constantly, and I constantly offend him. Luckily, he's very progressive and he doesn't care. But all the time, it'll be like, well, who cares if that thing's on Easter? None of us give a shit. And he's like, I have to go to church. And I'm like, oh yeah.
See, I think we miss that a lot. I think we miss that most of the people who we're arguing against, they're humanists too.
Yeah.
They're just religious humanists.
Totally.
So what I like to do is I like to show them how we have common ground. I'm a humanist. By the way, just to let you know, I actually, like 3 days ago, just became a certified humanist celebrant with American Humanist Association.
What does that even mean?
Through the Humanist Society.
What means is a I'm, celebrant?
Meaning that I can legally officiate weddings in all 50 states. And it's accepted by all 50 states. It's not like an online ordination that you buy for $15.
And
it's,
you're also not saying, oh yeah, I'm a priest.
Right, which right. I like. And you're not like, I'm a high priest of Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster or something that someone's going to laugh about.
Yeah.
You can do that. You do eulogies, things like that. Bedside, talking with people about end of life issues and Death with Dignity Act and things like that. So
that's really cool.
Mostly weddings, but I think it's just really, it's a really important part of the movement.
Did you do it just like because you wanted to? Did you do it because you have some friends that are getting married coming up and that was, you know, for timing purposes?
I've had a lot of listeners ask if I could marry them. And I go, well, I was technically ordained from a long time ago, but it was kind of a silly thing.
And that's also like, and I don't know, it's a little gross to do it that way. I feel like you don't want to do it as an ordained pastor because your whole thing is that you're not a pastor.
Absolutely.
I like that. Absolutely. That's very
so
cool.
So this is from a humanist perspective, and it's really, really cool. So that's what I like to do is I like to find that common ground and say, look, I'm a humanist too. So I meet them in that emotional ground where they are. And talk about, well, yeah, actually, my love for humanity. Look, when they're holding doors open for people or helping their friend build a fence, that's not because of the Bible. It's because of their humanist principles, just like you or I would help, right? And so I meet them where they are. I talk about those things. And then I go, you know, actually, my love for humanity was the first thing that made me start challenging how a good God could exist with all these horrible things happening. And they're like, oh, yeah. And so I go, you know, when I was a Christian, I had a problem with that. Can you help me reconcile that? How do you deal with that? And it may be the first time they've ever thought about it.
Yeah.
You know? So that's, I think that's part of the way we do it. And then I think you're right. There are some people who are very much affected by Dave's approach, that me being nice to them and sweet to them and respectful to them will be not effective at all And then they hear Dave go, you know, it's all fake. God is Santa Claus for grownups. And then they're like, what?
Tough it up, asshole.
Yeah. And then they're shocked into going, wow, you know, I can't believe someone just made fun of religion. So,
I think even more than that, Dave's approach may not even be quite as effective on the individual level, but it's much more effective on the policy level. And I think that we have to be operating on those levels, because when it comes to atheist, quote unquote, activism, a big part of it is making sure that we're providing a safe place and an environment that's inclusive and inviting for people who are going through that journey in their lives. Another big part of it is making sure that the laws, you know, we live in a society of a lot of Christian privilege. So it's about making sure that the laws protect us as non-believers and give us the same kind of rights as believers. I mean, look at Barney Frank, who came out after he left office. He came out as gay, like decades before he came out as an atheist, because it was safer in office to come out as a gay man than it was to come out as an atheist. I mean, that kind of shows you where we are in terms of our relationship with our government. And so I think that David's approach is very important for that. And to me, that is an approach that I really respect, and it's an approach that I admire. And I think when I do any sort of activist work, I see that level, and it's important to me.
Yeah.
I'm just not sure if the I don't know. I can be rough around the edges without even realizing it. Yeah. So I think that trying to work on the empathy and the softer approach has been, it's been a struggle for me, but it's one that I think is really important. And, but I am a little jealous. I have to say, I'm a little jealous that you still live in the thick of it. Maybe I would hate it. I probably would. I mean, it's why I left, but it's so cool that you can affect so much change. You know, I'm like a coastal person now. And sometimes I forget, like, this is not what most of American society is like. Los Angeles and New York are very different speeds.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, this is where all the media is. It's where all of the ideas that go into what everybody views every day are. But most people don't live on the coasts, and most people don't think the way that coastal television says that they should.
Right. Here's the unique thing about Texas. And as I'm traveling and people, I have my license plate is atheist.
But it's a Texas license plate.
Texas license plate, all seven letters, and it's official. Everybody that sees it, they think it's fake. Like, they think it's just a front thing.
Yeah.
And they always walk around to the back and go, is this for real? And the unique thing about it is people keep going, how are you getting away with this stuff in Texas?
Yeah, they're like, how are you not, like, killed?
Or your truck's all keyed up. Yeah. And I say, you know, I have a whole lot of really cool conversations with some awesome people. You'd believe it or not, 90% of the response I get are thumbs up and hell yeah, and guys on motorcycles and people walking up going, I can't believe you're the one that took it. It wasn't available when I tried. We are everywhere. So why are there so many atheist groups? There are tons and tons of groups popping up in Texas. Why is that the case? I've been asked that a lot, even on this tour, especially being out on the West Coast. They're like, you're from Texas?
Yeah.
And there are atheists there? Like, people are shocked. And I go, look, here's the thing. If you just look at Texas on a national map, it's going to be red.
Yeah, of course.
But if you look at Texas by itself on a county map, you're going to see Dallas is blue. Houston is blue.
Denton's probably blue.
Denton absolutely is blue. Austin is blue. And our entire coastline is blue.
Yeah.
So what you have is the densely populated areas are very liberal and progressive, right? It's these scattered out counties like Midland and Odessa and Paris, Texas, and all these country towns that are still Republican. And so what you have is this densely populated area being governed by Republicans or state representatives that do not accurately represent the views of the majority of the populace.
Which is kind of how we feel in America at large right now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's so true. It's like, but you're not representing my interests somehow, these people. And you know what? I think that there is also, there's this kind of historical need to keep electing Republican representatives in Texas that even my mother is very, like, progressive. She's a humanist. She's pretty liberal. But I remember when Obama was first running, she was kind of like, I don't know. I mean, McCain has a track record and I trust him, and Obama doesn't have a track record and I'm just not sure, because she just had this very moderate view. And not until McCain picked Sarah Palin as a running mate and my mom was very insulted did she actually actively, you know, kind of go towards that liberal side. But I think what you see a lot more in Texas is this interesting kind of moderate conservative or moderate liberal person who is kind of, you know, walking that line. Like during the primaries, when people talk about undecideds, and it's so easy to roll your eyes and be like, who the fuck is undecided? How could you not know who you want to vote for?
Right?
It's like a lot of those people are living in these kinds of areas. Mm-hmm. You know what? I'm going to take a quick break so that we can clear our throats.
I'm so sorry.
Had a little bit of a, yeah. No, don't be sorry. It's been a long tour for you so far. Yeah, and we're going to come right back and keep chatting with David Smalley. Here's a special announcement for my viewers who are serious about anime. I am hooking you up with the world's largest lineup of anime on Crunchyroll, and it's all free for 30 days. Just go to crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. No, you can watch as many as you want, anytime, anywhere, and here's the kicker. There are absolutely no ads. Crunchyroll has top anime series like Naruto Shippuden, Attack on Titan, or Sword Art Online. You can also watch the most current episodes of brand new shows like The Testament of Sister New Devil and Cute High Earth Defense Club Lub and Military and a whole lot more straight from Japan, guys. And they're available as soon as an hour after premiering. They're all professionally subtitled. They're right there for you. It's as if you live in Japan. You can get them right away. So, guys, you can check out all of your favorite anime completely ad-free anytime, anywhere, in beautiful HD quality and across all of your devices, your iPhone, your Android, your tablet, or even directly on your TV through your Xbox, your Apple TV, and a whole lot more. Crunchyroll is obsessed with anime, just like you. It was built by hardcore fans. They've got a massive selection of the most explosive and the highest level anime. So if you want to binge on some awesome new anime, don't wait. Go to Crunchyroll right now. And for a limited time, don't forget, you're going to get an entire month free when you sign up at crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. You will also be supporting the podcast. So again, don't wait. It's crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. Go there now. Once again, that's crunchyroll.com/talknerdy. Thanks, Crunchyroll. All right, we are back with David Smalley. We both had our own random like coughing fits during the break.
That was
so we're
weird.
Back, but a little kind of raspy.
Yeah. I don't know where that came from.
Me too. I like swallowed my own spit or something gross. And we were talking about my dog Killer, who's the cutest ever. And I love him. And you just got a new dog. What's your dog's name?
Nyla.
Aww.
Bill Nye. Hello?
Nyla.
She's Nyla the science puppy.
Oh my God. What kind of dog is she?
She's half schnauzer, half poodle.
Oh, she sounds adorable.
She's a rescue.
Yeah, my dog is a rescue too. It's hard to say what he is. I think he's mostly dachshund, but he has like long hair and cute ears that make me think maybe he's got some, I don't know. Something cute and little in him, but he's very dachshundy. He's like long and has a big long nose. And
yeah, she's very cuddly. We love her. She's so awesome.
How old is she?
2.
Okay, so she's not like peeing on the carpet 10 times a day.
Not 10 times a day.
That's good. Yeah, she's getting there.
Like once a week. She's like, it's cold. I'm not going out there.
That's what, ooh,
you
cold.
Can clean that. You can clean this up.
It's cold there? That sucks.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You live in LA.
How much are you loving it here, by the way?
It's beautiful.
Right?
Gosh,
so you can see why I left. It's like it had nothing to do with the people. I miss the people in Texas. They're so nice. It's just the weather's so good and it puts me in a good mood all the time.
But I'm like, now I'm weighing you know, 114 degree weather 30 days straight versus like I-90 traffic. Like,
oh, yeah. I mean, the traffic's horrible.
For us, or was it 91 traffic, I think, and then I-5 and... Look, let me just tell you, from my perspective here, we considered moving to this part of the country because every time we come, it doesn't matter what time of the year, it is gorgeous.
Yeah, it's like Hawaii. The weather never changes.
It's beautiful. Yeah. We absolutely love it. We love the coastline. We love being on the water. And even when you're away from the water, the trees, the mountains, the hills, the rolling hills, it's absolutely gorgeous. But here's the thing. In Dallas, and Dallas is one of like the top 10 worst traffic cities in the country.
Yeah, which is, it's nothing compared to here.
Nothing.
Well, because also here, I still will hold tight to this claim, which is that Dallas has the best drivers in the country. I've been to a lot of places, and people are not as good as they are in Dallas because it's this perfect mix of friendly and aggressive. Like, people drive fast in Dallas. Yeah. They drive fast, and they're defensive, but they have somewhere to be. You know, they drive very fast because, like, in Florida, people, like, they have a minimum speed limit on the highway because it's, like, all old people. And they go, like, way under. It's frustrating as hell. So in Dallas, people drive fast. Don't get me wrong. But if you ask them if you can cut in, they'll wave you in. And they'll smile really nicely at you.
Yeah,
it's a totally different vibe than you get out here.
I've noticed out here, no one asks shit. They just go.
No, you just go.
They come
and
over.
Also, like, I literally vented to my shrink about this for, like, 10 minutes. This was a portion. I paid him money to listen to me complain about the fact that in Beverly Hills specifically, where everybody drives a really expensive car, nobody can drive. It's so scary. And it's this entitlement. There's this kind of, the phrase I always use is, it's your world, man. I'm just living in it. Because people will just do crazy shit.
I could totally see you doing that in your car by yourself. Your world, dude.
Yeah, it's cool. I'm just whatever. Like, they'll do crazy shit, like turn right from the left lane, or just like be driving down a normal street going 40, and then all of a sudden they're like, I want to park here. So they'll slow down to like 5, no blinker, no, and you're like, what are you doing? It's because they're only thinking about themselves.
It's incredible.
There are definitely pockets out here in Los Angeles. Big pockets of people who were just raised in a very kind of privileged, it was really sort of, I don't know, reinforced from the time that they were young, that they're great and they're winners.
So this is a cultural thing.
I think so, heavily. Whereas in Texas, I definitely feel like there's a stronger sense of community. And I think that there's a stronger sense of neighborly goodness. Like if you're at the gas station pumping gas, the guy next to you will just be like, how's it going?
Absolutely.
And you're like, what? Like,
I know. And I do that out here and I get really weird looks.
You get weird looks. Like, my mom told me when I first moved to New York, the very first time I ever rode the subway, I called my mom later and I was like, I hate this city. I don't know what I'm doing. And she's because my mom's from she's from Puerto Rico and New York and then moved to Texas much later in life. And she was like, what happened? And I was like, this woman was sitting there and I asked her if I could sit next to her. And she gave me this super mean look and I didn't understand. She was like, she was totally blown away that you asked her if you could sit down. Like, you just sit. She's like, what are you doing? You don't ask somebody.
I would totally do the same thing. I'd be like, you mind if I sit here? Someone's
exactly.
sitting here?
Yeah. And they're like, what?
What's going on with you?
Are you
going
to murder me? And you're just like, oh my God. So yeah, it's definitely a different vibe. And I think that it affects the way that you interact as a religious person, as a non-religious person, and the way that you talk about those things. You had mentioned before the break that we're all humanists, atheists, Christians, Muslims, whatever. We're all humanists. We're all really interested in the human condition. And the golden rule is kind of the core value in every religion, right? Is do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And I would also secondarily argue that we are all agnostic. And a lot of people take issue when I say that.
I agree.
But nobody fucking knows. Nobody really knows. And so we're either just theistic agnostics or we're atheistic agnostics.
That's my argument exactly.
Totally. Like, I think, I don't know, but I always kind of err on the side of, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I'm almost positive no, but I don't really know. And I don't factor the idea of God into any of my daily decisions. And there are a lot of people out there that would agree if I were to say, you know, true or false, you factor God into your daily thoughts and activities. And they'd be like, no, not at all. And then you're like, well, do you believe in God? And they're like, yes. But it's just this, it's such a background thing of just kind of like, but if I'm wrong, what if I go to hell? That sounds shitty.
Right. And then that's not a real belief.
No.
That's playtime. That's pretending.
But it's really common. It's really common that people are like, fuck it. I never think about it. I never factor it in, but maybe. Everybody else says so. My mom kind of thinks so.
I've said that a long time.
So.
I've said that for a very long time. When you talk about having knowledge of there being a deity or not, everyone's agnostic. But based on the information you have available to you, you either believe it or you don't believe it. And so when I'm debating someone about it, I take the God thing out of it completely and I go, okay, listen, I have a Ferrari in my garage.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that or not? Their answer is, I don't know if you do or not. Right. But You see my house. You've seen my Ford F-150 pickup truck, right? You see the clothes I wear. Do you think I own a Ferrari? Yes or no? And they're like, well, you could have one. It could be donated. It could be. I'm like, right? No, that's good. Think about it. I get it. But based on the information you have, you either believe I do or you believe I don't. Yep. And so I don't say I disbelieve in a God. I don't say I believe there is no God. I say I suspend my belief until I have sufficient evidence. So that makes me an agnostic atheist. And I think that should be the default position.
I agree. And I love the way that, because that's an argument I make a lot, and people who are better philosophers than I am will sometimes argue against my claim, mm-hmm. which is that it is very different to say that I believe there is no God than it is to say I simply don't believe in God. Mm-hmm. Because that's a default position.
Absolutely.
Like when you're born, you don't believe in God until somebody teaches you the concept of God, and then you develop a belief. It's a mm-hmm. socially induced structure. And so it's the default position is to just not have that belief. And that's where I am. I mean, granted, I had to reject at some point because I was raised Mormon. So mm-hmm. I was indoctrinated into a belief. But even when I look back at that, I don't think I ever actually believed. I tried, so that was a big part of me leaving the church, was that I tried really, I didn't have to reject it later. I didn't have to come to some moment that said, oh my God, I've been living a lie. I left the church because I was like, I'm trying really hard. I'm trying really hard to please my parents and to have this faith and to have this moment of, you know, a testimony. And it's just not coming. And the more I think about it, the more ridiculous it's starting to seem to me. I don't think I ever really believed. And to me, the idea of just not believing is a fundamentally different thing than saying, I believe there isn't one.
Right.
Because that makes it then seem like it's just as, it holds just as much weight as believing in a God.
Well, you're making a positive claim of belief.
Exactly.
That you cannot prove.
That you can't prove.
Right.
Because you can only disprove things.
Usually, but yeah, that
you can't even disprove God because it's outside of the realm of the physical world.
Well, you can disprove specific gods.
And you can disprove acts of God that fly in the face of natural law.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's another argument. But a lot of people that do that, you're right, they will, I wouldn't call them better philosophers, because philosophy will start getting really muddy and ridiculous, and they'll stretch it as far as they need to.
The reason I say that is because I have tried to have this argument with the physicist Sean Carroll many times, and mm-hmm. I respect Sean so much, and he's a great friend of mine, and he's way smarter than me. And so when he starts going off on that, and he says, no, I can prove to you there is no God, I'm like, you're like a theoretical cosmologist, and you might know things that I don't know. So I'm just going to withhold my argument.
He could do enough math to show you that because these two planets are here, there's no way it's possible.
Yeah, like, okay, he's got some sort of reasoning behind it. And I'm like, I trust you as an authority figure because you've written many books about things like time and the Higgs field that I couldn't even begin to try and comprehend. So
I'm glad that we spent most of our time talking about belief and talking with believers, because
me too.
I was a little worried because I don't know that I'm nerdy enough.
Oh, you're hugely nerdy.
To be on Talk Nerdy. I'm a horrible, horrible atheist.
What?
I don't fit in with atheists normally. Like I'm.
Oh, because atheists are usually like wearing Buddy Holly glasses.
Oh my gosh.
Like,
let me just tell you.
Let me tell you about that article I read by Dan Bennett. Yeah.
Well, let me just say, I get made fun of on Dogma Debate all the time for being completely just culturally ignorant of pop culture, things that Doctor Who, I have no clue. I have no Star Wars, I didn't watch it until like 6 months ago for the first time. Star Trek, I've never seen more than 3 minutes of an episode. Like I'm complete, like people just get so turned off by like, wow, you're so ignorant.
But I appreciate that about you because, so my podcast is called Talk Nerdy. Previously, my series on HuffPost was Talk Nerdy to Me. It came from an HBO pilot that I did Talk Nerdy to Me. And it very much, the word nerd there, I laser focus specifically was using to describe my excitement and interest and passion for science. I am a science nerd. When it comes to the nerd, like when you think of my friend Chris Hardwick, the nerdist, mm-hmm. the king nerd, the types of things that he is very nerdy about, I'm not that interested in. Like, I don't read comic books. I'm not into sci-fi. I don't watch fantasy.
I'm totally not into sci-fi. And yeah. That's like, it's usually a mark against me. And they're like,
I know. I'm a bad nerd, right?
Because you don't like Lord of the Rings? I'm like, I couldn't hardly sit through it. It drove me crazy.
I hated Lord of the Rings. And I don't watch Game of Thrones. It pisses people. And I'm like, I'm sorry. I don't need dragons in my, like, I'm a science nerd. Dragons are hard for me to swallow. Like,
exactly.
I'll watch a movie. I'll watch Jurassic Park 50 times over.
Right.
I don't want to watch Lord of the fucking Rings.
Right.
It's just not that interesting to me.
The thing about it, I appreciated it after I debated someone on it. We fought about it because to me it was silly. To me it was something like the Mountain of Doom, mm-hmm. and everyone had like a name like Zorgon, Dordoff, and these weird names. And I'm like, I can't, like, I'm rolling my eyes. Then I find out it was written like a long ass time ago.
Yeah.
And I go, oh, wait, all those cheesy things that I've heard of were probably copied from this. So I can appreciate
totally.
That like I would appreciate, say, the Beatles. Like,
well, and also,
you know,
Tolkien, there's so much like literary. I mean, there are college courses dedicated to like understanding his worlds and to under. And I think here's the difference. Being a nerd, as Will Wheaton very like put it in an eloquent way that I'm not about to do, but being a nerd is being so passionate about something, even though the norm doesn't fully respect it, even though everybody else in society might say, oh, seriously, you're into that? Being a nerd means fuck off. I don't care. I'm so passionate about this. I'm going to do it regardless of what people think. And then finding other people who are also passionate and just owning it. And so whether or not you love Lord of the Rings, I could give a shit. Like, I don't love it. I can't even watch it. But I think it's amazing that people out there
right.
find these things that they're passionate about and they care so fundamentally about them. And I respect that. And there are times when I see the fun people have dressing up as Harry Potter mm-hmm. and going to like Harry Potter parties. And I'm kind of like, I want in on that. But it doesn't resonate for me.
Like Comic-Con and the
yeah,
whole
well,
thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, Comic-Con, there's like other aspects. At least it's so big now that there's a lot of really cool stuff at Comic-Con.
That like Iron Man and stuff like that.
Totally, that's yeah. Stuff, there's like yeah. comic book movies that like everybody's
so,
seen.
I guess that I'm totally like an atheist Bible nerd.
Yeah, you're a Bible. Oh, you're a
like,
huge
I'm,
Bible nerd.
I'm all about that.
Like, you're way nerdier about the Bible than I am, for sure. Like, I'm an atheist, but I could not. I'm not scholarly about the Bible. I spent many years of my childhood in seminary courses. Like, as part of being Mormon, you have to go to seminary before school every day mm-hmm. when you start high school, and it's really intense. And it's split up between Book of Mormon, Pearl of Great Price, Doctrine and Covenant, all of these Mormon books, mm-hmm. but also the Old and the New Testament, because as a kid who's more, you don't know the difference between the two. Like right. you'll be talking to somebody and they'll be like, yeah, but Peter said blah, blah, blah. And then you're like, yeah, but Nephi said blah, blah. And they're like, who the fuck is Nephi? And you're like,
well, the Mormons hold that as all equal doctrines.
Exactly.
Though. They're
and,
all equal.
And they're all cross-tabbed when you have your book. And you just don't, yeah, you don't even realize. And so you have to learn a little bit that, that like it's different for different people. And so I was forced to like learn a lot of that shit. And I promptly tried to forget it when I left the church.
I see.
Like for a lot of people, it becomes a passionate part of their atheism. And for me, it's like equivalent bullshit that I just like stopped caring about and could not cite.
I just realized something.
What?
From the time I was like 5 years old, my mom took me to like bars. Like she would go to like country and western mm-hmm. dance clubs. There were pictures of me like dancing like 5 years old. By the time I was 14 or 15, I was playing drums in country bars.
Mm-hmm.
My sixth birthday party was in a bar.
Mm-hmm.
My mom would have to take me home at like 11 o'clock because the smoke was getting to me.
Yeah.
I'm like this little kid. And so by the time I was 18, 19, I was playing drums in this heavy metal band. And then like on Sunday, I was like moonlighting as like a church drummer. But I was in the heavy metal band from 19 to 20. And then from 20 to 22, 22 and a half, I was the lead singer of a band. And we were touring and doing you know, bars and clubs all over the country. And now I freaking hate it. I hate being in bars. I don't like that scene at all.
Yeah.
And it just hit me when you were saying that. Even when I go to like a talk or a conference and the restaurant is loud and it feels like mm-hmm. a bar atmosphere, like I get like lightheaded. I'm like, I hate this. I want to get out. I just will go stand outside for like 10 minutes to reset and then I can go back in. It just, it irritates me. It really puts me in a bad mood. And so that may be what it is. I was kind of forced into it for most of my life. found something else to do outside of that. And I'm like, I have no interest in going back to that.
Yeah. And you know what? It's not like it's, I don't think that it's fair when people claim that these early experiences and then the rejection of these early experiences color our deeply held beliefs and philosophies. Like it really bothers me when people belittle my, my understanding and my organization and my worldview, by going like, oh, of course you're an atheist. You were raised Mormon. Like, obviously. And I'm like, oh, fuck. Like, that's not why. But it is definitely why my atheism has taken some of the shapes that it's taken. Mm-hmm. It is definitely why I'm not a Bible-thumping atheist. Like, a lot of atheists are Bible-thumping in that, you know, there were studies that came out, like, I think upwards of, like, a decade ago now. No, it wasn't that long ago. I feel like it was maybe 3 or 4 years ago because I was at HuffPost when there were a lot of these studies that were being published that showed that atheists were better biblical scholars than many religious people because it's a heavy part of that atheist scholarship is really studying the Bible and understanding our arguments. And for me, that was never a component of it. It was really like, for me, maybe it's because I come from a scientific place that parsing words and picking apart different verses is like just not that interesting. And it's very easy for me to just throw the baby out with the bathwater and go, pretty stories, good stories, like is all bullshit. None of it makes any scientific sense. Like I could, the burning bush and the talking snake and the blah, blah, blah. Like I can just list things, but it's not that interesting for me to be like, what exactly did Paul mean when he was working? It's like, I don't care. I had to do this shit every day before school when all I wanted to do was like, you meet with the boys and hang out with my girlfriends and I'm sitting here talking about Nephi again. I don't care about Nephi.
That makes sense. No, I could totally see that.
Just like, you're like, totally I don't want the smoke and the noise. Yeah. And I'm dancing for the old people in the bar.
And see, for me, it was just believe in God, do the right thing, yada, yada. God's watching. Yeah. Don't masturbate. God's totally watching
That's
too.
That's true. Because some of those denominations are less scholarly. Like definitely right, Baptists are much less scholarly. And Mormons are very scholarly about it.
Yeah. But I'm walking around as a Baptist knocking on doors in the youth ministry, right? And I'm like, I'd like to talk to you about Jesus. And this older black woman goes, honey, you need Jesus. And she slams the door in my face. And I thought, what if I have the wrong Jesus? Like, so I start reading, right? And I'm paying attention. And then I'm like, I totally have Jesus. And I get baptized. And it's at the moment I got baptized that I was like, I'm not good enough to be a Christian.
Aww.
I'm a part of this group now, and I don't accurately represent the view. So I'm like 15.
Don't you hate that guilt? Absolutely. There's so much guilt in religion. Right. That's such a bummer.
So what it did for me, though, is it made me say, I better know I have the right Jesus. I better know this little town in Texas and my First Baptist Church of Everman that I've got it right. And so I started having these doubts. Like right then after my baptism ceremony, I'm standing there like in this fog thinking, I feel like Jesus just hired me and I don't know my job description. Like I am so underqualified. And I'm like this 15-year-old kid scared to death that I'm now in Jesus' army and I have no weapon, right? And so this pastor leans down to me and he says, you know, son, you can't just say you believe. You have to know it to be true in your heart. And I was like, bam, I don't. Yeah. And I have so much to learn. I wasn't an atheist, but I that story's in my book, and I called my book Baptized Atheist because it was at the moment I was baptized that it actually became serious for me. And so then I had a desire to go read this Bible, figure it out, study it, so I can tell the whole world the truth about Jesus, and I can go back to that woman's house and say, I found the right one. Here it is. I can save your soul. And then I was just like, I got 4 words into it and went, well, that's not right.
Yeah.
And then 20 words into it, I found 11 mistakes already. And then it was just kept unraveling over time. And
which is why most denominations don't want to baptize 15-year-olds. Like in the Mormon church, I was baptized at 8. They consider 8 the age of consent. Maybe that's a holdover.
Do they also call it the age of accountability?
Probably.
Like
that's
if you're
like a
8
better,
and you say, I don't want to do it, you're going to hell if you like, you just go to spirit prison.
You're right. You just go to outer darkness with the gnashing of the teeth. I very specifically remember lots of G-N-A, gnashing of
gnashing.
Teeth. Yeah, that word always stuck with me. But and maybe that's a holdover from like creepy kind of pedophilic Mormon, you know, the Mormons with lots of wives and 8 years old is old enough. I don't know. I have to sneeze. Hang on.
That's awesome.
Fun.
And dogma debate, we would have left that in.
I'm leaving that in.
Really?
Totes.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm leaving that
cool.
in.
Cool. This is almost live then.
Exactly. I'm like, I don't fucking
Are you leaving all my coughs in too earlier?
Yeah, I'm not going to sit down and edit all of that.
Very cool.
But yeah.
I don't have time for that.
Like, come on. Who has time for that?
Time for that?
I'm airing this tomorrow. I got a busy day planned. So 8 years old, it's like, are you fucking kidding me? So right. I did it at 8. I got baptized, but in even at 8, you're at least starting to think about things. But I got baptized because I wanted to please my parents. I know that now. Like,
oh, yeah. Totally. My friend Jason that you talked to, that came on the show, who was ex-Mormon, he said there's this really sick thing where a kid gets up to give his testimony.
Oh yeah.
And the parents are like whispering in their ear what to say.
This is
like,
what they all say. Did he do this? I'd like to bear my testimony. I know the church is true. I love my mom and dad. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
Yeah, exactly.
Like every kid says the same thing. Because the first Sunday of every month, you bear your testimony. Well, you don't have to, but the Mormon church is super weird and there's no pastor. So it's very like, the people, what am I, it's very late at night. The congregation.
Congregation.
It's like the Congress. The congregation are the ones who give the talks and they're the ones who kind of run the Sunday school. Mm-hmm. And so the first Sunday of every month is the Sunday where you fast. It's the Sunday where you take the money that you would have spent on food and you donate it to the church. And it's a Sunday where the adults of the population will go up and they will, or the congregation, and quote unquote, bear their testimony. So lots of them are crying. Lots of them are talking about the last thing that happened in their lives that reinforced their faith. Mm-hmm. But the kids always feel pressure to do it too. And so they'll like file up, but they all say the same fucking thing because they don't have a testimony. It's like even that. You can watch from the outside and be like, that kid's just like saying what everybody else says.
What you're really doing is you're instilling in this indoctrination process that you have to do things whether you like it or not,
mm-hmm.
and you've got to please the masses, and even if it means pretending.
Yes,
which is why so many Mormon families seem very like Stepford Wives robotic.
Because they are. Yeah. They really are. Because like to the outside world, they're very kind and they're very sweet. And I'm not saying there's like abuse or anything going on the inside. Most Mormon families are very family oriented and some of the most amazing people I've ever met. But there is definitely, they're normal families. Like they have the same issues as anybody else, but they would never show the outside world. They definitely like have that smile on their face, get it together, look pretty for the camera. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's part of the vibe. I mean, it's pretty interesting. But I think that's cool that you got baptized at 15. I think if more people got baptized at 15, you wouldn't have as many fucking people getting baptized. Because most people are baptized when they're babies.
Yeah, I mean, I explained that to say I think that's why I have a desire, because I wasn't forced to read the Bible. I did it like to make sure I had the right Jesus, because that lady slammed the door in my face and I was like, maybe she's right. I'm worshiping the wrong Jesus. And so I had that desire, so I sought after it. So when I went for my degree in psychology when I was in school for so long, I was like, I want to minor in world religions and I want to really understand it. And so my whole, I've been like, I have to seek more knowledge about it. So for you, it's almost like we're complete opposites in that. It's like I was
forced to learn.
You
all
were
that
forced
stuff
to
really
it,
early.
And it was hidden from me.
And I wasn't forced to learn it from an objective standpoint either. I was forced to learn it in an indoctrination kind of way, like from within the church. You took world religion. I mean, I took some religion classes in college too, because I was a philosophy minor. So from that aspect, it was interesting, but I definitely wasn't interested in learning like Mormon religion. That was like, fuck that. Like, I don't want to learn another thing about Joseph Smith or Brigham Young. And it's funny too, that when you actually do start studying on your own, you start to realize like, wow, like there's a virgin birth in like every religion. Like there's, you know, it's like all these things that you thought were so Christian. You're like, oh yeah, that theme just kind of, the resurrection. I've seen that before.
I was so obsessed with just religion in general when I was doing my college work for psychology. They would try to have me write about something else. I'd have like a 15-page essay due, and it had to be about why psychologists aren't allowed to do medicine, and at least in Texas it was. And it was like, you're not allowed to do medicine. You have to refer to a psychiatrist for medicine and things like that. And so they were like, write a paper about medicine that's gone wrong.
Interesting.
And I'm like, okay, I have no interest in medicine whatsoever. So I made up this pill called Jesus, and I spelled it G-E-E-Z-U-S. And I was like, so the problem is, before you start just passing out Jesus to people, you need to make sure that like it's not going to do more harm than good. And I made it all about religion, and my so professor funny. My professor loved it, actually.
She loved it. That's good. Or he? She?
She. Yeah.
I assumed she. That's kind of shitty of me, but it is like 75% women in psychology right now. That's great, though. That's really cool. That's one thing that I've got to say that I still love, too, is that regardless of where you live, regardless of how conservative it is where you live, you find a college town, you go take some classes at a local university, even if it's a commuter college. And for the most part, especially if it's a public university, you will find people who are like-minded, who are liberal, who are progressive. You'll find professors who you can really talk to, who you can find refuge with. That's where they're hiding. Mm-hmm. In case if you can't find them in your community, that's where they're hiding. It might take driving 2 hours to the nearest college campus, but you'll find cool events going on there and you'll meet really cool people.
And SSAs. And events and really cool stuff.
Definitely. Yeah. So on that note, I want to let you get back because it's late and I've kept you for so long already. But before I go, I close every episode of Talk Nerdy by asking my guests the same two questions. So I'm going to ask you the same two now.
Okay.
And it's going to be extra interesting because I'm sure you're so tired. And I'm about to ask you some big picture questions.
Uh-oh.
So the first one is, when you think to the future, what is the thing that is like the most disconcerting to you? What keeps you up the most at night? What are you most worried about? But then on the flip side of that, the next question is, what are you most excited about? What are you most optimistic for? Silence.
Silence bothers me.
It's because you're a radio host. You gotta you gotta own the silence.
The thing that bothers me the most, and I'm glad you worded it that way, is there's a book out that I had the pleasure of doing the voiceover for called Nonbeliever Nation by David Niosi.
Okay.
It's at atheistaudiobooks.com, by the way. And in there, he quotes like Taft and very, very early presidents who were running on a conservative sort of platform.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when asked about things like creationism and evolution, blew off creationism like it was completely ridiculous. And I believe it was Taft who actually said something along the lines of, I can't believe at even this late of a date, you are now asking me such silly questions.
Mm.
They mostly spoke highly of Darwin and things like that. And I think, believe one of them referred to Darwin as a bulldog or something. It was like, he's so smart and he just keeps going and he's so amazing. And across the board, even the believers, even the people who openly, I guess, represented themselves as a Christian, completely rejected creationism.
And they were pro-education.
They were pro-education. They were pro the people. And they were shocked that, like, way back then, like, they're like, this is the modern days, baby. And they were we're talking about Taft. And like, these are the modern days, and you're asking me about, like, 6 days of creation? Come on.
Yeah.
They were certain that it was gone, that it was on its way out. There was this fringe population who still believed it. And now we have a very liberal president who I honestly believe is an atheist, who will get up after every speech and say, God bless the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this entire population of politicians who are... There's no way Taft thought it was going to end up like this.
Yeah.
Like, this is the worst case scenario for our earlier politicians.
And it's not just a fringe group anymore. No. It's got a lot of political power.
We're almost like the fringe group now. And so what worries me the most, what keeps me up, is that somehow, even though they are completely and provable wrong, provably wrong, I should say, they've somehow gained traction, being so wrong. And the truth is so important to me that it's bothersome that without the truth, that with guilt and lies and fear-mongering, they are able to gain traction in a political movement. And that's bothersome to me. And so on the flip side, the exciting thing is that means we have a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of ground to cover. And I think we're starting to find a way that we can work together. And things are sort of these groups of cogwheels now that at one point completely disagreed with one another. Like, oh, YouTubers don't like bloggers and bloggers don't like podcasters. And now it's like there's kind of this thing where things are sort of turning together.
Yeah.
The more liberal atheists, there are libertarian atheists, there are conservative atheists. Dave Silverman came on and talked about him and Jamila going to CPAC and how that caused a controversy. And he came on and cleared it all up on Dogma Debate. And it was really, really cool. And so we've got all these different people. I mean, I used to work for Dave Silverman, resigned, did an open letter criticizing the way he operated and why I resigned. And now we're like texting, hey, how's dinner? How are the kids? How's this going? And we're like friends now, which is awesome. And now he's asking me to come and do shows at the American Atheist Convention. So now there are these cogwheels working together in ways that we never thought we actually would, which is why, just for your listeners only, the Secular Media Group logo, the parent company, is three cogwheels working together, because we're coming together and we're actually making things happen. And so what I'm most excited about is the progress that's happening and how fast it's happening. Like, I see that it's almost like we feel like we were losing the game, and now there's this amazing comeback opportunity.
And I would say that there's a lot of evidence showing that non-believers, you know, however you want to define that, all the different definitions that people use, is the fastest growing minority group in the country.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are a lot of people who agree with so much of what all of these amazing people are saying. They just hadn't found, I don't know, the strength or the acceptance from their neighbors or whatever it is to own a label.
Right.
But the thoughts are there. Yeah. You know, and the community is growing every day.
And information is at our fingertips like never before. It's in our pockets like never before. There's a comedian, Ron White.
Mm-hmm.
He's a part of the Blue Collar Comedy Tour, very country. He's got this stand-up bit where he talks about how smart his son is and how his son is constantly figuring things out on the internet. He's like, you ask that boy anything, he'll just boop, boop, there's the answer, dad. And he's got this whole country thing. I told him, I can channel my inner Texas at any time. And I'm sure you could too. And so he says, when I was younger, I had to believe my mom. He's like, she told me all kinds of things and I just had to believe her. And he's like, 4,000 years ago, a man named Noah and his family built a giant boat and they sailed the world. And he's like, you tell a kid that nowadays, they'll go click, click, bullshit, you know? And even hearing him say that with his country accent really goes, man, it doesn't matter. I mean, indoctrination is losing ground because
totally. That cuts deep when the people who are watching that show and they're laughing when he says that and they're going, right, yeah, that's insane,
right? Like, that's right, we have internet now.
Yeah, it's like Noah and the boat, that's ridiculous.
exactly. So in the grand scheme of things, the internet is like nuclear warfare to indoctrination. Because not only that, there was a 2-year-old. I was at my talk tonight. There was a 2-year-old who picked up her mom's phone and went to YouTube and started typing the right letters to bring up the cartoon she wanted to watch, recognized the letter, clicked it, and watched a little cartoon on her mom's Android. 2 years old. She can't read, but she recognizes the shapes of the letters. And
she's
goes,
seen her mom do it so many times.
Yeah, that's the thing I want. And she's like, she does that all the time. She plays games. She goes to YouTube. She can't read, but she's clicking on things based on what she's typed before. And I'm like, you're not going to be able to hide stuff for them anymore.
No, you're not.
The way cults work is they hide information until you've been indoctrinated and you cannot hide information anymore. So these cults are getting more and more remote. The walls are getting higher and they're getting more violent and they need to be stopped. But
they're getting less people joining. They just have less of a pool to even choose from.
Absolutely.
Because you go into a city and you try to get somebody who's on their, you know, down on their luck, a young woman, this very common young woman who's like having problems and, oh, but I've got the answer for you. And, you know, this guy, he says this. And it's like, no, that's not true. The New York Times would never know. That's not true.
Exactly. So the thing I would warn against is to make the same mistake Taft did. is to say, wow, our progress is so amazing and the internet is so popular and this isn't going to last very long. And then to kind of lay off and go, this is about to be awesome. We're going to get it. No, this is when we need to kick it into overdrive. We all need to work together and stomp it out like you would a cigarette that you don't want to catch on fire. Yeah. Make sure that thing is completely out before we can move on, because otherwise it'll come back to bite us. I guarantee you Taft never thought it would be like this. He never imagined there would be a Sarah Palin or a Michelle Bachmann or a Ted Cruz.
He'd be so depressed.
He would be sad.
He'd be sad, but he'd be like, what the fuck? Yeah.
What did I do wrong? Blow his mind. What did I do wrong?
Yeah. Seriously.
So don't get complacent and let's stick with it.
I think that is really, really great advice. David, I'm so glad that you joined me. Before you go, let everybody know where to find Dogma Debate, where to find you on Tay Interwebs, all that good stuff.
DogmaDebate.com, Facebook.com/DogmaDebate. We have all this behind-the-scenes content at login.dogmadebate.com. We have over 600 members that join us for all sorts of behind-the-scenes stuff. And probably the biggest way to get involved with what we're doing is atheistaudiobooks.com. It's a marketplace of secular ideas and books. It's ultimately through Audible. We're partners with Audible, but the landing page is atheistaudiobooks.com. That's where we can be found.
So. I love it. All right, guys, go visit. And don't forget that I do a weekly-ish segment on Dogma Debate called, what is it called? Get your science on.
By the way, I'm actually getting a lot of really good feedback on that.
I'm so glad. It's been so much fun.
They are loving you as a part of the show.
So it has been so much fun, and it's so great to be able to get my science on every week-ish.
You know how things go, people.
This was awesome because we got to really talk for a lot longer than those like 15 or 30 minute segments that we've done historically. This was really fun.
As long as we've ever talked, actually.
Yeah, and we weren't talking about science at all. We were just talking about...
And you weren't having to address any ridiculous creationist arguments, which, by the way, I asked you to do because I was like, no, you don't understand. My listeners... Their family members quote this website and go, this is real stuff. Exactly. No, it's not.
Yeah, it's not so much for the... It's important to be able to have an arsenal, you know, when somebody comes to you and says, but so-and-so said that. And you're like, no. But when they go, but why? You got to know how to say,
right.
Why not?
And so that's what your segments do. And I'm not going to make you do it every time because obviously you come to the, and Brandy was telling me the other day, she's like, the biggest compliment I get on you and something Brandy has said too is that you're such an effective communicator. Hmm. Is that you take stuff that would either normally be boring or way over people's heads and you break it down and it sounds like just your best friend talking to you at Starbucks going, hey, this thing's going on. And they feel like they can really relate to you and connect, and that's what we're all about. So,
well, I would say the same thing right back to you because you know some wonky shit about the Bible. Like you do. You have a really good understanding of some of the more esoteric and more what I think of as like scholastic and complicated concepts. And you're able to do the same thing and break those things down and talk about them in a manner way and in a how does it relate to my life right now kind of way, which is very hard to do when we're talking about like ancient texts. And I think that's also very important. So I thank you for that. I thank you for doing what you do every week. And I thank everybody who tuned in for tuning in today, for continuing to tune in week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.